On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
The Midwest is mostly covered by ABC bakers. The South has got a lot of Little Brownie. Washington, Oregon, Idaho, all Little Brownie. And California's divided awkwardly as well.
That's John Schloss, a graphics and data journalist for the LA Times. He's talking about Girl Scout cookies, which are back in the market now. And it might surprise you to learn that not all Thin Mints are created equal, even if you've bought one box in Santa Monica and one box in Santa Ana. And that's because across the country, troops are working with two different bakers. Gustavo Arellano joins me and John to taste cookies and weigh in on which bakery does them best. Arellano's editor of the OC Weekly and host of KCRW's Orange County Line. Hi, gentlemen.
Hola, Evan.
Hi.
So, John, let's start with you. I don't think this was widely known that there were these two bakers and the cookies were different. How was this revealed?
So a couple of my colleagues, Ron Lynn and Rosanna Shaw, discovered that there were a couple of Girl Scout mothers, a copy editor from Orange County and another editor from L.A. County, who had different Girl Scout cookies, and their minds literally exploded right there in the office.
You created a graphic for the LA Times that outlines the distinctions between the two cookies. Who are the two bakeries working with the Girl Scouts?
So there are the two bakers. ABC Bakers is one. It services a smaller segment of the country. The other is Little Brownie Bakers. ABC is based in Richmond, Virginia. Little Brownie is based in Louisville. And nationally, they service like a whole different chunk of America. Like Los Angeles is serviced by Little Brownie Bakers. They have the Samoas, the Tagalongs, while ABC Bakers covers Orange County, a good chunk of the desert in California in the Central Valley. And they have the peanut butter sandwich or the peanut butter patty.
This is so odd because I think a lot of people before your story broke just had the impression that it was monolithic, like a Tagalong is a Tagalong is a Tagalong. The lemon cookie is a lemon cookie. It's the same everywhere. But now we have visual aids, which we, of course, will post on our blog. And we have these two plates, one with the LA cookies and one with the Orange County cookies. And immediately the thing I notice is the lemon cookie. In Los Angeles, we are totally getting short shrift with the lemon cookie. Gustavo, why don't you describe the difference between the two?
The lemon cookie from LA County seems like this dour fortune cookie turned into a frosted thing. And I remember having them in the past. I'm like, wasn't my favorite. I'm always going to be a peanut butter patty and Samoa type of guy. And then a couple of years ago, I started noticing these lemonades. And so the lemonades are the lemon cookies of Orange County. They're humongous. It's like shortbread with a big, huge coating of yellow frosting on the bottom. They're tart. And I now say they are the most underrated Girl Scout cookie in the world.
This is so strange.
It's stunning. It's absolutely stunning to see these cookies. And now I always, for people who have never had the lemonades, I offer it to them, and it's a revelation anytime they have them.
Okay, I guess we should move on to the Thin Mints now. John, why don't you describe just visually what the difference is?
So the LA Thin Mint is much more dark, and it's round. The edge is not kind of crimped like the Orange County cookie. And the Orange County cookie has these little very distinct dimples on the top and a texture, whereas the LA County Thin Mint is much more smooth on top.
Yeah, it's like a blob.
Yeah.
It really has no character, where I think the Orange County cookie looks like an adorable little sort of Danish cookie that you might find in one of those Christmas tin boxes.
It reminds me also kind of a Ritz cracker with the little dots and the ridges on the edge as well. But hey, two for two, Orange County, go.
So then the peanut butter patty, to me, the LA cookie just looks like it has much more fat. The way that the chocolate adheres to the top of the cookie is so much more shiny and smooth. Is that true?
Yeah, it's totally true. It has about half a gram more fat than the Orange County variety and about 5 more calories.
Whoa.
And is that true throughout the entire range? Is there a large nutritional difference between the two bakeries?
There's a slight one. The L.A. County cookies tend to have a lot more fat associated with them. So for me, it's like a lot more buttery taste, which being from the South, I'm just really into that.
Okay, so let's taste a Samoa.
Oh, yeah. All right.
So you've got the Samoa. Orange County calls it a caramel delight and about a third of the country.
Mm-mm-mm.
The L.A. cookie is much more like a macaroon that's held together by the other ingredients, whereas the Orange County cookie is a cookie.
Yeah, it has more of a coconut flavor, too, the Orange County one, a little bit brighter.
There's probably coconut extract in the biscuit, but there isn't hardly any biscuit in the L.A. cookie.
It's a creamier flavor on the Caramel Delight, with the Samoa is a little bit denser and darker. Comparing them both right now, I'd go with the Caramel Delight.
Okay, where do we go next, gentlemen? Thin Mint or peanut butter?
Let's do peanut butter.
So it's a tag-along, and then what are they called in Orange County?
Peanut butter patty. Ooh.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah, there's a good crunch in there under like a very soft, lovely layer of peanut butter.
Okay, so the Orange County one is going to be so different. Peanut butter patty. Crunchier.
Mm-hmm. Less of a peanut butter flavor, though. Like, I have to say the tagalongs are better because what I love about this cookie is that you have the chocolate, yes, but peanut butter. I'm a fiend for peanut butter, so I would go with the tagalongs on this one.
So previously, did you understand that you would have to get an L.A. Girl Scout to sell you those to get the really hit of peanut butter you want?
No. Now I'm going to have to tell my Girl Scout sources to give me as many tagalongs. Well, it's interesting because now I'm going to have to split my different cookies. Okay, give me the Caramel Delights from O.C., but the tagalongs from L.A., and then it'd be awesome if, like, more regional variation. Like, you have, like, this weird cookie from the South. And I know the Girl Scouts, they introduced, what was it called? Cranberry Snaps. It's a newer cookie. Like, more of, I think it's a vegan one?
It may be. It's only available in Orange County, that one.
Oh, there you go. It's okay. It's not my favorite.
So you guys consider yourselves very special down there.
Of course we do. We always have. Exceptionalism.
Okay, so are we going to go with the lemon next or the thin mint? I think we should go with the lemon.
No, I think we should save the lemon for the very end.
Okay.
Ooh.
Okay, well, there you have it. Okay, let's go for the thin mint.
I don't get too much of the mint flavor in this one. It's more of the biscuit. It's very crispy, but the mint gets you at the very beginning, but it sort of disappears really quickly.
See, I kind of like that because I don't really, I know this is heretical, but I don't super love mint cookies.
Me too. So let's see how the other one is, because that's what I never really liked about this cookie was that it was too minty.
Is this called a thin mint in Orange County as well?
It is, yeah. They're both called thin mints. It's the only cookie that actually has the same name in both areas.
Maybe we've been demonizing thin mints for too long.
It's definitely crunchier.
Yeah, I would say that all the Orange County cookies have much more biscuit, and that's why the L.A. cookies are fattier, because they have more stuff going on.
Still not a thin mint fan, but I would say the L.A. one, I think, has more texture and depth to it than the O.C. one.
How is it decided what troop is going to get what cookie?
Well, so each troop falls into a different Girl Scout council. In the country, there are 111 of them, and it's up to the council to decide which baker they're going to go with. So in Los Angeles, the Girl Scouts of Greater Los Angeles went with Little Brownie Baker, whereas in Orange County, they went with ABC Baker.
That must be a really passionate taste test for when the councils are about to make up their mind.
Right. Other things go into it, too. We actually have two councils this year that switched bakers. In Minneapolis and St. Paul, the council servicing that area switched from Little Brownie to ABC. So they're going to be getting, like, the lemonade cookie and the Caramel Delight. And also in New Orleans, strangely enough, in the South, that Little Brownie lost a whole council to ABC.
What a fierce and strange rivalry. Did they give reasons for why they switched?
The folks in New Orleans said that one of the reasons was technology-based, that ABC bakers had, like, great iPhone apps where the Girl Scouts could track how many orders they had delivered and how many they were, like, expecting.
Teaching the next generation of capitalists.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, so let's now do the final, which is the most diverse of the two cookies.
Lemonade, or what are they called in L.A.?
Savannah Smiles.
Savannah Smiles. I love that name.
Yeah, and they are kind of like a little smile, almost like a crescent.
Ooh. It's tart, powdery. I'm not a fan of powdery cookies. I got powder on me.
Yeah, but the powdered crunch, sugar.
That's a great cookie for, like, with coffee.
Yeah, it's a good dunking cookie because it would absorb a lot and not fall apart. But now I have to have this beautiful Starburst thing. I've never had one. I'm so excited. Thank you. Thank you for giving me the big portion.
Yeah, this is your first time. You have to get the bigger one.
Wow, look at the frosting on the bottom. Looking at this beautiful cookie, I expected more.
Wow.
Oh, wow. We pumped it up too much.
I guess so. You don't like the frosting, that nice layer at the end that coats your tongue
smooth
with the frosting?
Vanilla frosting.
I thought it would have. Oh, it's vanilla? See, I thought that the frosting would have a really big hit of lemon. And it does not.
I have to say, maybe just because this is the last cookie and we have so much sugar in our palates right now, usually it has more of a lemonade kick to it, that, at least in my experience with it. Because I have to admit, even when I tasted it here, I'm like, I remember it with more lemon.
And I have to say, the experience of eating these kind of cookies when you're on your couch and you have a big glass of fresh tea or a giant mug of delicious cappuccino and you're just powering down through the sleeve, that's a different experience.
It totally is. It totally is.
This has been so much fun. John, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
And thank you, my dear Gustavo.
Gracias, Evan.
That was the OC Weekly's Gustavo Arellano and John Schlois of the Los Angeles Times. We've had our fill of Girl Scout cookies, tasting both the LA and Orange County versions. Let us know which cookie you prefer by leaving a comment on my Facebook page. Search for Evan Kleiman and click like. Next, we move from the sweet to the savory, and from Southern California to Southern food. That's when good food continues.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. On the eve of her halftime Super Bowl performance, Beyoncé released her latest single, Formation. Her reference to Red Lobster in the song caused sales at the chain restaurant to soar by 33%. Yet it was her standout line, "I've got hot sauce in my bag, swag."
I got hot sauce in my bag, swag.
That inspired writer Mickey Kendall to explore the significance of the reference for Eater. Hi, Mickey.
Hi, how are you?
Tell me what the title of your essay is.
Hot Sauce in Her Bag, Southern Black Identity, Beyoncé, Jim Crow, and the Pleasure of Well-Seasoned Food.
That is a lot of weight for a line in a pop song.
I have a lot of feelings about food and culture.
Well, so do we. So it's perfect. When I read your piece, I was really excited to talk to you. You describe yourself as a Southern Black girl by diet. So what was the etiquette regarding food that was passed down to you by your grandparents?
For Black Southern families, my grandparents came out of Louisiana and Mississippi and Arkansas in this weirdly, bizarrely complicated fashion that is the Great Migration. And growing up, we were supposed to eat what we were served, period. You didn't waste food. You didn't refuse food. But it was perfectly fine to add salt after you tasted the food or to add hot sauce. Nobody blinked, right? You could add more seasonings, but you always tasted the food first and you ate what was in front of you. And if it required a little doctoring to make it to your taste, that wasn't considered rude. My grandmother usually didn't have salt on her table, but that was more about her controlling how much salt my grandfather ate. But there would always be hot sauce, pepper. You might have different little relishes, right? Like if you're having greens in our family, there will be tomatoes and onions and cucumbers in a sauce with black pepper, vinegar, and a little sugar.
So going back to the hot sauce in the bag, did your grandmother have hot sauce in her bag?
My grandmother always had hot sauce or hot peppers because my grandmother's family was originally out of Louisiana. So it was rare that anything she cooked needed hot sauce. But other people's food might need hot sauce. But my grandmother always had those little red peppers, the dry red peppers. And she kept hot sauce for times when obviously you couldn't just add red peppers to something. And you could kind of discreetly throw some hot sauce in soup or the greens at the barbecue or whatever. Because we grew up with spicy food at home.
So once people started to eat out in restaurants, this became a thing, right?
Oh, absolutely. And you keep in mind that my grandparents were born and raised during Jim Crow. So if they traveled, you had to have your own condiments. You had to sometimes have your own eating utensils, all kinds of things. Because even places that would serve Black people, unless they were explicitly Black-owned and run and only served Black people, if they served white people, Black people could not eat in that restaurant.
But sometimes they were able to take out.
Right. You could pick up from a window off to the side or out of the back, depending upon where you were. In some places, they couldn't even take out. But that's why when we get to the 60s and the lunch counters, part of the whole thing was that Black people had been able to spend their money there, but they could not sit inside and eat.
Could you explain what the Green Book is?
So the Green Book was a travel guide created by a gentleman for Black travelers who would theoretically be traveling around the South or around the U.S. anywhere because, you know, we tend to think of Jim Crow as a Southern thing. It was Jim Crow America. So it was originally published as the Negro Motorist Green Book. It went for, I think, 30 years or so, mid-1930s to shortly after Jim Crow, let's say 1966, I think, 66 or 67. And if you wanted to advertise in the Green Book, then you would write and say, Black travelers can spend the night here. Black travelers can eat here. You would take the Green Book and you would plot your route from point A to point B. Like I had family. My family was Great Migration and came up to Chicago mostly. But some relatives went on to California or tried their luck in New York or Seattle, things like that, Texas. So depending upon where you were going to visit, like my grandmother was going to visit her sister in California. They used the Green Book to be able to traverse from Chicago to Los Angeles safely with their family and their kids.
And did the Green Book offer advice as to what you should pack in the car?
You couldn't be sure what gas stations you could stop at. You didn't know where you could spend the night, what restaurants, that kind of thing. And he printed about 15,000 copies every year. And you would literally use the Green Book. My grandmother and among her estate, we found a couple of old copies that, you know, just things she had kind of had scattered around. But you would have separate facilities, and then many places in the North also just flat out excluded Black people. So this way, you knew which hotels you could go to, restaurants, gas stations, things you might need to get you from point A to point B. But, you know, the Green Book would even tell you where to find tourist homes, which would be in areas where you would not have a hotel or guest houses, that kind of thing. There would be people who you could write ahead and let them know you were coming and approximately when you'd be there, and you could rent a room from someone who lived in the area who would rent to a Black traveler or a Black traveler and their family.
So I think that for so many of us now, it might be hard to imagine a time when food wasn't really highly flavored. I mean, like here in Southern California, food everywhere you go, it's filled with flavor bombs. But we're talking about a time where kind of the Midwest palate seemed to be everywhere. And food is such a comfort for all of us, right? It's so much embedded in how we're fed by our families. So just that simple thing of being able to add a dash of spice to a really bland plate can make the difference in how you wind down at the end of a day.
Well, and I think it's one of those things where even now in the Midwest, depending upon where you are here, you still might need some hot sauce in your bag.
So do you think that segregation still exists in the way we eat?
Oh, absolutely. I know there's a saying that the most segregated hour in America is 10 a.m. on a Sunday. Well, the second most segregated is probably dinner time, right? There are restaurants, if you're in Chicago, for instance, which is where I am, there are certainly restaurants where you'll see all kinds of people, but you'll also see a certain amount of segregation. And this is a piece I'm going to be working on in terms of things like barbecue, where the barbecue restaurants will actually serve completely different menus depending upon the race of both the owner and the patrons. So on the South side of the Black barbecue spot, I can get rib tips If I go to one of the new hipster spots, not only do they not have rib tips, they don't even know what you're talking about if someone asks for them.
What about food's role in marginalized communities?
So this is one of those things where food gets really important when you don't have access to other things, right? Being able to eat well, being able to serve a meal. I think people have this odd idea that the soul food menus that you see, like the movie Soul Food, you're not eating greens and ribs and all of these things every day, but that's a Sunday dinner. It's a come together with your family and you have a roast chicken and greens and macaroni and cheese and candied yams and that kind of thing as a celebration, as a way of making it a communal event. It's never really been intended to be a thing where you eat tons and tons of this same food every single day, because among other things, that's boring. And so in a lot of marginalized communities, foods that are for us special occasion foods or foods that carry a lot of weight. I get nostalgic for certain things that my grandmother made, things like smothered chicken or neck bones, because that connects me to her. That connects me to that time and that place in my life where she was the person who I went to for things. And that's something I think that kind of gets lost from a lot of marginalized communities. We may not be able to pass down a lot of items, but we can pass down recipes, we can pass down these tastes, we can share with each other in the moment and across time these flavors that matter so much in our community. And it's a way of sharing your culture. I jokingly tell people my love language is food, because if I like you, I'll feed you. And it's one of those things where you will see us sharing with each other our community, our culture in a way that it doesn't matter if outsiders don't understand it or if outsiders judge it or whatever. This is a moment that we can share with people we care for and people who care for us.
So how great is it that a pop song enabled us to have this conversation?
I actually really love this song and I have played it a million and one times. But I think it's great to see this sort of writ large. I mean, Beyonce kind of situated it in the beginning and where her family comes from. And I have a relatively similar family background of, you know, they came from the South. They went somewhere else in search of this better life. And now across the internal diaspora that is Blackness in America, because a lot of us are in the North because of the Great Migration, this is something we all have a connection to, even if our traditions are slightly different. My daddy, Alabama.
Mama, Louisiana. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Mickey.
Thank you for having me on.
That was journalist Mickey Kendall. You can get links to her story, Hot Sauce in Her Bag, and to the Saturday Night Live spoof referencing Beyoncé's song on the Good Food blog. I got hot sauce in my bag. I don't know about you, but all this talk about spicy food's making me hungry. Let's see what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We have had a lot of hot weather lately, and it's always interesting to check in with the farmers and the chefs to find out how the weather is not only affecting the farm and the growing, but how it's also affecting the menu and what new seasonal things may be popping up right under our nose. Right now, I'm talking with James Trees, who is the corporate chef at Superba in Venice. And James, you're here every week shopping for the many restaurants that Superba operates. Tell us seasonally now what you're looking at and tell us what you're going to be preparing.
Well, we're kind of in the middle of the season right now. So what you're seeing is a lot of tendrils, fava beans, peas. You still have all the great winter produce because of our long growing season and, you know, the different microclimates that are around. So definitely citrus, definitely. The first strawberries are already in. They smell amazing every time you walk by them. Harry's Berries always does a great job. Having that kind of resource makes job as a chef very easy, you know, to be able to have access to amazing product. And that's the reason why we want to support the farmers. And that's the reason why we're here every week.
Tell us something that you're going to be buying today that you're going to be cooking with.
Okay, so we're definitely going to be using, I'm doing a Tehachapi grain dinner with Alex Weiser. And so the real reason why I'm here this week is because I want to buy some purple cabbage. And I like to use Glorious right now. But as Laura told me, you know, we got to diversify and help out everybody. And so I'm going to go check out Miss Kalal and see what she has as far as that goes. And also we use cabbage a lot in the restaurant. And we use it for our coleslaw that we do on our fried chicken sandwiches, kind of based on the Bake Sale Betty up in Berkeley, and they are famous for their fried chicken sandwich. And now I think we've kind of nailed it. I had to actually fly up there, get in line and eat one of those sandwiches to figure out exactly what it was that we were going for. And it's like one of those things like traveling to a destination to try one ingredient that is on one dish that someone is really well known for. That's like kind of like, okay, it was an eye-opening thing. Like that's all we were missing was, you know, some onions marinated in vinegar. Crazy, right? So
is the recipe, the cabbage, the coleslaw kind of goes two ways, the mayonnaise base and then the more acid base. So what kind is that?
Yeah, we definitely are fans of the vinegar-based coleslaw. So we actually make a red wine vinaigrette and then macerate our onions in that and then take the onions and toss those through the cabbage, carrots, and then chopped parsley. So like the freshness from the parsley, the earthiness from the carrots, the cabbage is like picks up all the flavors of the sugar that like fall out of the carrots. And that's like the way you really make coleslaw. Coleslaw is always better. You make it, you wrap it, and you leave it for an hour, right? So like an hour later, that's when you're going to get the acid breaking down the cabbage, making it soft. Or you can just hand macerate it and just like really work it over. But I'm not a big fan of adding mayonnaise to a bunch of stuff. It's not like really what I like to cook. It's not how like we like to live down here. So, yeah.
And I'm thinking cabbage. I mean, it seems like it's a summer picnic thing. Are we looking at maybe a year-round season here for cabbage?
Yeah, for sure. We use it all year round. Like, but the great thing is you have red cabbage, right? And that's actually what I'm shopping for because I like cooking red cabbage with port wine and a little bit of sugar and veal stock and cooking it down and actually braising cabbage. Like that really Austrian German technique is actually the base of the dish I'm doing at the Hatchby Grain Dinner this Tuesday.
James, you said you're looking for red cabbage for the braise and then the green cabbage. What is the difference in the flavor?
So red cabbage is sweeter just to the bite. If you're doing like a raw cabbage dish and you want to go earthy, I like to go with green cabbage because it has more earthy undertone.
So tell us a little more about the Tehachapi Grain Dinner. What are you raising the money for?
So we're raising the money for Alex Weiser. 100% of the money from this dinner goes right to Alex Weiser for his grain project. It's 100% a nonprofit, but we want to be able to like get local wheat back to Southern California. We're really excited about the dinner and having all the chefs, and we're going to cook outside in the farm, what we call the Farm Superba, which is like this great outdoor space that we have where our aquaponic towers are that we actually use every single day.
It's just so wonderful to see the love that you chefs have for these farmers and for the ingredients. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me and can't wait to see you at the dinner.
That was James Trees, and he's the corporate chef for Superba in Venice. James mentioned that he likes to buy cabbage from Tamai Farm, and I am talking with Gloria Tamai. We might as well be calling this Gloria's Farm because you are kind of the face of Tamai Farm, Gloria. He loves your red cabbage, and he also gets your green cabbage. So can you tell us, do you grow a lot of cabbage? Is it popular, and are they different to grow?
It's not that hard to grow it. We grow it because, you know, we had our customers from every week after week. Yeah. So that's why we keep growing.
So when you pick your cabbage, is it there's still some loose leaves around it, but it's still fairly small?
When we pick our cabbage, we make sure it's firm. We try not to peel it that much. That way it look nice and green and fresh and tasty.
And is there more flavor in the green leaves?
Oh, they say it have more vitamins. I don't know, but I think it is. Mm-hmm. I don't like it have white cabbage. I like it more when it's, you know, light green.
Right, right. And the average size of a head of your cabbage, it's about the size of a cantaloupe?
Well, sometimes it's a cantaloupe. It goes bigger, smaller, medium size. You know, it's up to the customers how they want it, bigger or smaller.
And do you, as a customer, if I'm looking at a cabbage, do I kind of squeeze it, make sure it's firm?
Make sure it's firm. You don't want it too soft because when you slide it, when you slide it in something softer, it don't cut good. Okay. That's what it is.
And what about the red cabbage? Is that just as popular as the green cabbage?
No, that one is not. Mm-hmm. Oh, this way we only grow like one row and We don't sell that many those. I bring one bus, and I still probably have some left in there.
Some vegetables, when you cook them, all the purple goes away. But in your purple cabbage, it stays.
Mm-hmm. It stays, long as you don't cook it too much. But it stays, the green cabbage stays the same color.
Now is probably the perfect time to get cabbage.
I think so. Yeah. I think it's the best time right now because, you know, everything gets sweet. It takes longer to grow it. Even this year, it's been so hot. But in winter, usually the vegetables, it tastes more sweeter than in summer.
That was Gloria Tamai, owner of Tamai Family Farm. You can find them at many, many markets here in Southern California. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Get a recipe for that vinegar-based green cabbage slaw that James Trees went all the way up to the Bay Area to try on the Good Food blog. We've also got more information there about the Tehachapi Heritage Grain Project. In a minute, we jump across the pond to hear about a clothing label that's requiring its models to eat. Revolutionary.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. With famous plus-size model Ashley Graham making the cover of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, it would seem that size in the modeling world is widely accepted, but not so much. In fact, last December, France passed a law requiring models to provide doctor's notes proving they're healthy and not dangerously underweight before they can strut their stuff on the runway. Agencies and brands that break the French law face steep fines and jail time. Similar laws already exist in Israel, Spain, and Italy. There's no such law in England, but the women's wear label Rose and Willard made a splash recently by contractually requiring models to eat during photo shoots. Hedy Rahman is the label's founder. Hi, Hedy.
Hi there.
What caused your company to add these clauses to your modeling contracts?
Well, it was really, it came from our experience of having worked with professional models. And in our experience, they simply don't eat. And, you know, a full fashion shoot, you know, tends to take a whole day. And we found that the models just weren't eating at all. And to the extent that we knew they were hungry and they were progressively getting hungrier. And in one situation, we had one model who became actually quite delirious. He got to about 3 o'clock. And we actually had to send her home. And when we subsequently asked these models about, you know, why they weren't eating and what the, you know, what was restraining them in some respects, their response was that they were under pressure to either control their weight or lose weight, and made it very clear that they were told that they would get more work if they lost weight. Now, these girls were already, and I say girls because they were teenagers, were already very, very slim. And when you consider that they're under pressure to lose weight, it just seems ludicrous. From a moral perspective, you know, we're an ethical brand. We're very clear about our ethics at Rose and Willard. And, you know, it's very disturbing to watch a young woman, you know, go hungry for no other reason than she's under pressure to lose weight she doesn't need to lose. And so we decided to bring about a clause requiring her to eat. Now, it's not a draconian clause. We're not requiring her to eat. You know, we're not force feeding anyone. We're not going to stand over anyone while they eat. We're just simply going to ask her to join us for lunch in a very relaxed, informal setting with music, with the rest of the team, and just simply eat and enough food, a small meal even, just to sustain herself. That's all we're asking her to do.
I find it kind of fascinating that you were moved to do this, not only for the ethical reasons that you enumerated, but because simply the work product will be better. I mean, I don't know how many of us could work a strenuous day and still be mentally engaged in the work if hunger were really affecting us?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, it can be physically demanding. You're changing, you're moving around, you know, and it is quite a physically demanding role, which I didn't realize, you know, because my background is in fashion. And, you know, you can see these models getting tired, and you can see it physically. You know, it's there in their expressions that they are tired. You know, they sit down at every opportunity. But when they tell us that, you know, the extremes that they go to keep their weight down, eating tissues to stop their stomachs rumbling, just refusing to eat is really really worrying. And you think, well, why do they need to do this? This is the other question I'm always asking myself is, you know, how thin do they need to be? And the argument's always been that the clothes will look better on a thinner model. And I wholly dispute that. I don't think that's actually correct. You know, I've seen models who are, you know, a UK size 10, which would be a US size 6. And they look incredible in our clothes. And I think, you know, how thin do they need to be? I don't really understand the logic behind it. And, you know, we really feel that, you know, we need to safeguard the well-being of these young women. And that's really why we brought in this clause.
What is your typical sample size?
We started off with a UK size 10, which is a US size 6. We were requested to make it into a UK size 8, which is a US size 4. And then we were told, actually, that's too large. And can you make it into the next size down, which is a UK size 6 and a US size 2? At which point we refused. We said, well, actually, when you think of a model's height, they're usually, you know, very tall. You know, they can be as tall as 1.7, 1.8 meters. So, you know, you're looking at 5'10" or something of that order. They already appear very slim. Now, if you're a UK size 6 and you're that height, you're skin and bone, really. So we refuse. Now, what we've said to our customers is that on an individual basis, we will create a product bespoke, because we have had some customers who say, look, we're just naturally very thin, which is fine, but we're not going to treat a size 6, UK size 6, US size 2, as a standard size of a grown woman. It's not appropriate, I don't think. And it sends the wrong message to young women, I think, that is a normal size, because it's not.
So what range of sizes do you offer the customer?
We go from a UK size 8, which is US size 2, up to a UK size 14, which is a US size 10. And we have had questions about why we don't do larger sizes. And the reason for this is because we spend hours and hours and hours getting our fit absolutely correct. We don't believe that it's appropriate to take a small size and then just grade it up to, you know, size 16, 18, 20 and beyond. But watch this space, because we're certainly working on it.
Were you surprised at some of the negative press that you received from articles that accused you of, quote, policing women's bodies, to the reaction from Cosmopolitan, actually, that it's a form of exploitation requiring them to eat?
The one thing I'd actually say is most of those comments were actually based on other articles which were entirely incorrect. I think it was a sort of classic case of, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story. But I do think it's incorrect to think that we are policing women's bodies or removing their autonomy in any way, because that's not what we're planning to do. We talk about empowerment on our website. And I think, you know, when women are told that they should lose weight or they should control their weight, you know, for professional reasons, I think that's a form of subjugation. So we're giving them the opportunity to reject that. So I feel that that does empower them. And I don't think it's policing women's bodies to say, some just have a meal to sustain yourself, come and join us, you know, have a lighthearted, enjoyable lunch. I don't think that's not imposing anything on anybody. And any woman who felt that, she wouldn't need to sign the contract. She's well within her rights to say, well, actually, I don't feel comfortable doing that, and I don't want to sign your contract, and I would rather work elsewhere. And that's her prerogative, and we'd be happy with that. So I imagine the models that will sign this contract will be the ones who say, well, actually, I'm fine with how I am. I'm fine with my body. I'm going to do a day's work. Somebody's going to provide me with a nice lunch that, you know, will be of my choosing, and it will be, you know, it will be a day's work and I'll be fine. And that's how I'd like to think it will be.
Do you foresee that the United Kingdom will pass legislation similar to what was just passed in France?
the recommendation I believe that's due to go through, which is probably going to be released to coincide with London Fashion Week. I believe there's a recommendation for banning models under the age of 18.
Wow.
Yes. I mean, Italy, France, Spain and Israel have introduced BMI thresholds. I don't think that's a workable option, BMI thresholds. And I also think there will be challenges to having banning models under the age of 18. You know, according to a Model Alliance, over 50% of models start their career between the ages of 13 and 16. And I think the industry may, you know, argue that they're being discriminated against when under 18s can work in other industries. And the other element, I suppose, is, well, when you're 18 and 19, what protection is there if you're being, you know, sort of pressured to lose weight? We had one model who was 18, very, you know, beautiful Dutch girl, and was, you know, she was a UK size 8, US size 2, and was constantly told that if she lost weight from her hips and her thighs, then she would get more work. The answer really is self-regulation by the industry, which I know people will argue the industry has had every opportunity to self-regulate. But I think if, you know, the consumer applies moral pressure, especially to the very, very high-end brands and, the, you know, the upper echelons of the luxury fashion hierarchy, then I think that could make some level of change. That could engender some change. But I think it's down to the industry to make it happen, because it's such a difficult area to police. I think it's very difficult to find a way to put, you know, some measure in place that will protect these women.
That was Rose & Millard founder Hedy Rahman. The company is now contractually requiring its models to join everyone at the table for lunch. Imagine that. Speaking of eating, let's see where Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, is taking us this week. I don't think he needs a contract.
Oh, I thought we'd go to the Sunset Strip.
Oh, that's unusual.
And to a restaurant that's exactly where you wouldn't expect it to be, which is the reincarnation of Alma at the Standard Hotel.
Describe for a minute the kind of room and the kind of ambiance where Alma was previously located downtown.
For the existence of Alma proper, it was in a smallish room, high ceiling, next to a taxi dance parlor downtown, a deserted block. And it was one of the big events in the food world in L.A. last year when Alma closed. There was some legal dispute, but it was a restaurant that had been praised as much as any young restaurant has ever been praised here, right? I mean, it got named Best New Restaurant of the Year by Bon Appetit. The chef, Ari Tamor, was named Best New Chef by Food & Wine magazine. It scored pretty high on the Times 101 list. You would think it would be a successful restaurant, and in a way it was. In a way, maybe expensive tasting menus of abstracted food weren't exactly what people were looking for.
So what impressed me is how quickly Ari was able to pop up somewhere else after the closing of Alma.
It's true. It was within a month or two, I think. And it's not that just he came in as a guest chef or anything. They essentially brought the entire kitchen with them. The front of the house is professional and crisp in a way that it probably wasn't before. And maybe the most important thing is it's a party restaurant. I mean, the music is super loud. And on a Saturday, you can hear the boom, boom, boom from the dance club hidden somewhere in the building. And the tables are filled with people who are out to have a great time and pop corks on bottles of champagne and are happy to be eating good food. But in no way does it feel like a gastronomic temple.
Yeah, it's not a palace. In fact, the room is it's a diner.
It looks like a diner. I think its last incarnation may have been a diner. I mean, when the hotel opened a thousand years ago, I think Jean-Georges Vongerichten may have had control of the restaurant for about 5 minutes, but nobody's thought of it as a food destination for years.
And the other big difference aside from the room is that it's now an a la carte restaurant.
Right. You don't have to order the full menu.
So what does this newfound freedom sort of do to the perception of Ari's food?
People are thinking of it as light. They're thinking of it as full of flavor, which it is. They're thinking of it as delicious and novel. It's fun. It's party food. You know, you have, you know, bits of onion that are puffed into things like vegetable chicharrones that are served with like a guacamole made sour with sorrel, or, you know, a plate of smoked trout with roasted beets and salmon roe become, you know, something really fun to eat with champagne instead of, you know, one of a series of 10 courses. And they have most of their hits. They have those, you know, great butter roasted carrots that are almost like shriveled, but
so delicious.
So sweet, so good. And they have those, you know, the super fluffy light seaweed tofu beignet.
And those tiny little English muffins topped with the uni.
And just enough caviar to be tiny touch of salt. That's a good dish, those little English muffins.
Yeah, it always makes me feel like Alice in Wonderland, like the tiniest English muffin you've ever held.
It's true. You can feel like Shaquille O'Neal when you're holding one of those muffins. And some of the food is great. I don't think you liked it as much as I did, but I've always liked their dish of frozen foie gras, little cubes.
Oh, I love that.
With coffee granola, and then it comes on like a puree of livers of some kind. It sort of gives the liveriness dimension. There's the clam chowder, which is like a root vegetable velouté with
Two clams.
and some sauteed cubes of root vegetable, but the tartness of the what I assume is celery root is enough to give the soup the, you know, the character and the presence that it needs. It's a good dish. And one of my favorites is a dish of raw cabbage that's put on a bed of raw mashed avocado and topped with smoked almonds. I don't think they're molecular cuisine smoked almonds. They taste a lot like the smoked almonds you used to get in those foil packets on airlines. But it's enough to give the, you know, the funky, sulfury thing of cabbage almost a fleshiness.
So delicious, that dish.
It's good.
And fun to eat with your fingers.
Indeed.
So when I ate there, I'm not a big meat eater so much anymore. And I have to say that the piece of steak that I had was really wonderful.
It was a New York steak. It tasted like it had a ton of age on it. And from what I gather, they used that sort of Heston Blumenthal trick of flipping it every few seconds, which I imagine is like incredibly labor-intensive for a chef. But it has the effect of making it a consistent sort of bright pink throughout without the mushiness of sous vide. And a beautiful crust, and the flavors super developed. And I think he just served it with a couple of pickled chanterelles, which was enough, I think.
What about dessert?
The dessert is strange there. The thing I liked best was the parsley root sundae.
Which sounds crazy, right?
It sounds crazy. And when you get it on the plate, it looks crazy because it's mostly whipped cream with a little bit of ice cream on the inside. But there's, again, that aroma of parsley root. There's a bitter undertone from Fernet Branca, the liqueur. And the softness and the bitterness and the sweetness are really appealing. It's so much better than it sounds.
So really successful transition.
It's a good place. I hope they have a long run. They're talking about it going definitely through February and possibly till the end of May.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks, Evan.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about the reincarnation of Alma at the Standard Hotel. Text the words good food to 69866 and you'll get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. Up next, we learn how to use simple ingredients to make a complex, fantastic loaf of rye bread. Stay close.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
Welcome back to Good Food. Trina Hahnemann wrote this book, Scandinavian Baking, and it reminds us that while Danish chefs continue to shape the new normal, as diners expect innovation and surprise, there's a long tradition of baking in the region where basic ingredients prove that simple still pleases the palate. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Trina, your cookbook is incredibly gorgeous, and I love it as a reminder that there are breads that we can really enjoy making that are so healthy and literally packed with nutrition, even as all these low-carb avoiding bread diets continue to be all the rage.
Yes. I mean, coming from a Scandinavian country and the Scandinavian region, bread is like our staple basic diet, and whole grain bread, mostly based on rye and spelt, of course. I mean, we suffer too much on these diets. We can't do it. We have to have our rye bread.
You know, in all these years, I've been seeing so many different bread books come out, and I've interviewed so many talented bakers, and still I have not started my own starter from rye. But I think you might be my tipping point.
Oh, that makes me really proud.
And it's the picture of the bread that you say your husband has made for the past 15 years.
Yeah, going to make the rye bread once a week.
Once a week.
Yeah.
So describe that bread.
First, you have a starter that mine is, of course, really old because you reuse it all the time. But it's based on buttermilk and rye flour, whole grain rye flour. And then it has water and then crack rye. And that's about it. But it goes through a really long fermentation in between 30 and 36 hours. So it becomes, first of all, really tasty, but it also makes it really healthy. And then you bake it and you leave it another 12 hours or overnight to the next day because you can't cut it right away. It's really soft and has to, you know, settle a little. And then you cut it into quite thin slices and then you can eat it and it will last up to a week.
Describe what it looks like once you slice it.
It is really dense, dark brown, dark, almost dark brown. It becomes lighter the more days it goes on, but you can really see the grains inside of it and you can see the flour. And then it has this wonderful, sour, earthy smell that I really love. Super healthy.
So let's talk about that, because in Southern California, we're famous for loving our bowls, especially those of us who shop at farmers markets. It's so easy to take a grain and then just mix it with whatever's in season. Talk to me a bit about what you like to do with the rye grains once they're boiled.
I love to use them in soup, like in a tomato soup or a kale soup, or toast them in a little butter and put them on a potato soup. And then I like to use them in salad. And that, I mean, there's endless combinations of, you could, you know, kale, greens, root vegetables you've been roasted, sweet potatoes. I mean, more or less anything. And then it's also really good if you use it like a little bit like a tabouleh, where you just have the boiled rye and a lot of different herbs and garlic, olive oil and lemon juice. Beautiful salad. Of course, you can't eat the same amount because it's really filling. So it's a handful is enough to really feel full. And because it has so much fiber in it, it'll last you, you know, from lunch to dinner without a problem.
Everything we're looking for, really.
Yeah.
So this tradition of taking just whatever is in your imagination and whatever you have available to put on top of a slice of bread, give us some ideas. You've been here in LA for a while now.
Yeah.
And I assume that you've been to a few of our markets.
Yes.
So what would you do with some open-faced sandwiches?
I mean, toast it with avocado and a sprinkle of chili and just a bit of olive oil and lemon juice is amazing. For children, banana, butter and raisins. I mean, that's just a perfect snack. That's what, you know, children in Scandinavia get as a snack in the afternoon. Potatoes, boiled potatoes in cuts into slices, a little bit of cottage cheese or mayonnaise, chives on top, chop some kale and boil an egg, kale, egg, and then slices of tomatoes. cottage cheese, salt, and pepper. I mean, it's endless. You know, I could keep going.
So one of the images in the book that I found really intriguing because it reminded me of frico, which are the Parmesan crisps that you make that are super, super light and thin, is you have this whole series of crisp breads that seem practically ephemeral, like you could barely pick them up.
Yeah.
Could you describe them?
Yeah. I mean, you make a really, really wet dough, and in between two layers of baking paper, you roll it out really, really thinly, and then you take one piece of the paper off, and then you bake it in the oven, and it becomes super, super crisp. Of course, it's and then they cut, or what you say, they break really easily, but some part of it can also be a little bit chewy, which I love, that you have a little bit of both textures. And we eat them also for breakfast as snacks, and they're really good with soups and salads as well.
You have a pastry that's a winter spiced pastry.
Yeah.
Which seems just perfect for right now.
Yeah.
What is it made of?
It's the same kind of dough as a layered croissant dough, but I put spices into the dough. And then I put candied fruit and raisins. And that's, for me, that's winter. Because I come from a very cold area of the world. And we have 3 or 4 months of cold and snow we have to get through. And therefore, spices that warms you up inside are really important in the winter season.
I know that in Sweden they have this tradition, fika, where they have the afternoon coffee break. Is there something in Denmark that's similar?
Yeah, it's called kaffebord, which is the same. We have coffee with cakes. When I grew up, I spent a lot of time with my grandmother, and we would have cake 3 times a day.
3 times a day?
Yeah, but not much, just a little. You know, we'd have some leftover cake in the morning around 10 with a cup of coffee. Then we had an afternoon cake or cookies or buns with butter and raisins in them. And then there would almost every day be a new baked cake in the evening around 8 o'clock. But you didn't have 3 slices or anything. You just had a little. And when you go to somebody's house, you don't ask them, how are you? The first thing you will say as soon as they step in is, would you like a cup of coffee? And therefore, you need to serve something with it. So if you don't have a cake ready, you would have butter cookies or something else. Of course, that was how it used to be. In a modern world, these things changes. But we have a deep love of cakes.
So leave us with the idea of a cake, a simple cake that is perfect for winter, for an afternoon snack. Maybe not something elaborate, not something with whipped cream.
Pound cake. I think that's where I turn to every time. Or in this book, I have a really favorite winter cake, and it's evolved and in an evolved pound cake, and it's a chocolate coconut cake.
With what kind of flour?
A bit of wheat flour and then shredded coconut. Is that what you call it? Yeah.
Oh, that sounds marvelous.
Yeah. So it's very light, but then both cocoa and chocolate in it. So it has really deep flavor of chocolate, but still it's not that dense dessert kind of chocolate cake.
Thank you so much, Trina.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Trina Hahnemann. You can find a recipe for her malted rye bread with mixed seeds on the Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen whenever you want at kcrw.com via iTunes or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's mobile app. Many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Jillian Ferguson, Abby Fentress-Swanson, Camelia Tse, Laurel Garcia, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.